So I knew we had at least one, so over here.
Is Michigan asking for Texans?
Yes, there are a few Texans floating around as well. And for all of those of you who are of a Midwestern persuasion, I'd like to welcome you to a dangerous country of a completely different type. Those of us who reside on the plains are certainly familiar with the dangers inherent in springtime weather, shall we say, in that part of the world. But by coming here to the North Cascades, you come to an extraordinarily fascinating part of the world, and in some respects, some of the deadliest terrain that you will ever likely encounter. Now, you Washingtonians feeling any better? For those of you who are somewhat uninitiated in that respect, there is something referred to as Glacier Peak, which sits as the crow flies not very far west of us out here. It is a monstrous volcano, and it is part of the North Cascades volcanic complex. And as far as the United States Geological Survey is concerned, it's an active volcano. And it could actually take off and go any time, as far as
the just burned over like 10,000 years.
10,000 years, geologically speaking, is...
But I guess it shouldn't be too worried.
No, there's, we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll talk about how worried one actually ought to be in this. Geologically speaking, 10,000 years isn't a big deal. Obviously, St. Helens with activity over the past several hundred years, and Lassen with activity in the early part of the 1900s. Those of you not familiar with some of this, we start off up in Vancouver, British Columbia area, Garibaldi and Baker, and down here to Adams and St. Helens and Hood, which sits just outside the Portland area, and then on down past Mount Mazama, which most of you would know better as the Crater Lake area of southern Oregon, and then into Shasta and Mount Lassen. Those are the great peaks of the Cascades. Oh, I missed Rainier. How could I have done that? The highest point in the state of Washington. Because I was in a hurry to get down to the Mammoth Lakes area of California. Who we got for Californians? There's the California crowd from where?
Riverside.
I'm sorry. I used to live in Ventura County. I lived in Thousand Oaks, so I hated to go to Riverside. But
did you go to Riverside? To live or to
live? Actually, to do a little work, I spent a little bit of time. I got my PhD at UCLA, and I did a little work in engineering geology over in the Riverside area from time to time. So, anyway, you guys all know about Mammoth Lakes. And the Lassen crowd as well. The United States Geological Survey took an unusual step in 1982 in that they issued a formal notice of volcanic hazard for the Mammoth Lakes region of California. I don't know if some of you guys remember that, but about the same time St. Helens went off, there were a number of 6-point earthquakes that went off around the Mammoth Lakes area, and the pattern of those earthquakes was too close for comfort as far as the USGS was concerned in terms of its similarity to Mount St. Helens. And so in 1982, the United States Geological Survey issued a formal notice of volcanic hazard for the Mammoth Lakes region. It was a good time to buy a condo at Mammoth Lakes. Mammoth Lakes is still intact as we speak today. Those of you who have driven up through the Owens Valley to the Long Valley area up north of Bishop and up to Mammoth Lakes, One of the things that has always frightened me immensely about that is that as I drive through there, I'll be going down the highway, and at one point in time I will see a series of steam vents going off in different parts of the Long Valley Caldera. And then the next time I go through there, those steam vents move someplace else. The Long Valley Caldera, which is basically the base of a blown apart volcano, is 80 miles across, something like that. And the USGS assessment of that area, if the whole thing blew up, would be that it would be about 1,000 times the size of Mount St. Helens. Yeah, well, I'd hate to think what happened at Lake Tahoe. I'm not too worried about mammoth lakes, but I'd hate to see this sort of thing happen to Tahoe. You know, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous mountain lake. And so what I'd like to take a little bit of time today and talk about is, in particular, the nature of volcanic hazards, because they're actually varied and many, and some of them have some fascinating stories to them. May 18th, 1980, Mount St. Helens blows its top, and Dave Johnston, the USGS geologist who's sitting about 5 miles away, gets on the radio to Vancouver and he says, "Vancouver, Vancouver, this is it." And in a great many respects, that was it. That was it for Dave Johnston and for 61 other people who were killed by the eruption of Mount St. Helens. But it also, as I've talked with groups of people such as yourself, found that it's kind of a watershed. It's kind of an interesting moment in terms of public perception about the nature of volcanic hazards in this country. Because in some respects, I'm not sure people gave a whole lot of thought to what volcanic hazards were like, since not many people see volcanoes on a day-to-day basis. And most folks have perceptions of ancient Italians running away from Vesuvius in front of this lava flow that's about set to come over and engulf them as about their only recollection or focus or ideas as to what volcanic hazards are all about. And certainly, you know, lava flows are in fact hazardous things, but, and I was pointing this out a couple of days ago when we were talking on a similar topic, not many people, when you start looking at all the people who have been hurt or killed in volcanic earth, not many people are killed by lava flows. And I was making the point a couple of days ago that if you were to go to Hawaii, and that's another story, but I got straightened out by a Polynesian last time he was in Hawaii and said, "Gee, it's great to be in Hawaii." And he said, "No, it's not. You are in Hawaii. The Polynesian is so phonetic, all of the vowels are phonetic." But if you're in Hawaii and in the vicinity of Kilauea, you can always tell the geologists because they're the ones that are walking downhill backwards taking pictures of the lava flow approaching with their cameras. The lava flow does not move that fast. Now, it is obviously a hazard in that if you built a house there, and the house being a lot less mobile than you are, your house is going to have some problems. But lava flows are not particularly dangerous to somebody who has ambulatory powers. You can walk away from most of the Hawaiian volcanic lava flows. And lava flows have the additional property of behaving like liquid, so they tend to run down hills and valleys just like water would, and you kind of stay away from those parts of the world. If you're living in some place like Hawaii or Iceland, you've got to come to terms with this kind of thing because you're just living on a volcano, right? I mean, that's all the Hawaiian Islands are. That's all Iceland is a volcano. And there are some great stories that come out of this. One of them is found in this book, which you can pick up over in the bookstore, written by a man named John McPhee and entitled The Control of Nature. John is not trying to say on the fact that you can control Mother Nature necessarily, but he picks on three real interesting incidents where that is what we are attempting to do. And I'll go back through all three of them once real quick. One of them, for the Southern California crowd, is going up into the San Gabriels north of La Cañada and Flint Ridge, that part of the world, and trying to control those devastating debris flows that come out of those hills when you in fact have those rare years of high rainfall. And that harks back to those of you old enough to remember 69, 70, 71, when there were such devastating debris flows. The other one, which many of you probably have never given any thought to at all, is the story of the fight between the Army Corps of Engineers and the Mississippi River in southern Louisiana. The city of New Orleans, Louisiana, is betting its life as a major American city on the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. It is a staggeringly large fight. It is an enormous fight because the Mississippi wants to swing off into the Atchafalaya down to the southwest, and the Army Corps of Engineers wants it to go past New Orleans so that New Orleans can have fresh water, so that New Orleans can have a seaport, so that Mississippi can be traffic on down through the Delta. And I would venture to suggest the vast majority of you never had an idea of that. Not one, but it is an enormous fight, and it's where the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers spends a lot of time and money and effort. It's a fascinating story. The third story in here, though, is something on controlling the lava. And it has to do with a little island off the south side of Iceland. I'm not going to try and draw Iceland very well, but there's this island up here that we'll call Iceland in the North Atlantic. And down here on the south side of it is a little island, which we will blow up. And I will try to draw that a little bit better. And the island is known as Hemé. And in 1973, a volcano was born right about here on the island of Hemé. Just popped up, started going. Well, there's geologic reasons for that. This is the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and a hot spot to begin with. And this volcano started to grow right here. The town, which is also, I get it, referred to as Hemé, rather cross streets in there, sat right about here. And Hemé was not only the best harbor, this little area right in here, on the south coast of Iceland, it was the only harbor on the south coast of Iceland. And it was off the island of Hemé that all of Iceland's Atlantic fishing fleet was based. This volcano blew up and started flowing off this way, toward the north, toward the Hemé Harbor. This is where the Hemé Fire Department got involved, plus lots of other people. The Hemé Fire Department, among other folks, decided that there's more than one kind of fire to put out. And here's an absolutely riveting story from February of 1973 to July of 1973. The fight between Iceland, actually the entire nation of Iceland, and this volcano to save the only harbor on the southern part of the coast of Iceland. And for 5 months, a fight was carried on between the people on this island and the advancing lava flows that were coming out of this volcano. The story is absolutely fascinating and revolves around the fact that these folks thought they could pump seawater onto the front edge of the lava flow, stiffen it, harden it, cool it, and use that as a means for diverting the lava coming behind it and diverting the lava flow away from the harbor and away from the town. And that, in short, is exactly what they did. pumping millions and millions and millions of gallons of seawater a day onto this lava flow, they essentially modified the shape of the island of Hemi to something that looks like this. This all is additional land of the island. This sort of cross-hatched area right here. They sacrificed portions of the town. They went ahead and let some of the lava, or didn't fight very hard, but some of the lava that went to the northwest and into the town, figuring the town could be rebuilt. But the harbor would be impossible to reopen if they allowed all of this to go into it. And the harbor was, in fact, imposed upon by this. The entrance to the harbor formerly was about 1,000 yards across. By the time the steam had cleared, the entrance to the harbor was 500 feet. They'd cut very close. The end result, though, is that the harbor at Hemi is a better harbor now than what it was then. They still dredge it out, but now they have that 500-foot opening and a natural breakwater out here that they couldn't have hoped to build as well had they tried otherwise. An absolutely fascinating story, and John McPhee is a wonderful writer and tells it very well. And so there are people who live in areas such as the Hawaiian Islands or Iceland, and they're living on a volcano all the time and have come to some kind of terms with it, with that style of life. Now, another story that I'll tell you that came from this, after the eruption ceased in July of 1973 and everybody here could take a deep breath, the state of Hawaii invited the people principally responsible for this to come to the Big Island of Hawaii and meet with the representatives of the city of Hilo, Hawaii, about whether or not something like this would be possible with respect to the lava flows that would come down off of Kilauea and threaten the town of Hilo, Hawaii. And that is a very real possibility. Hilo is situated basically at the bottom of the valley down which all this lava would come. And as a result of that meeting, there was a policy formulated. There was a policy formulated that the city of Hilo Fire Department would do what it could to save an individual house from an advancing lobe of lava and try to cool that off and try to protect the house. But the state of Hawaii would not, in any way, shape, or form, attempt a diversionary technique like they used here on Hemi. The state of Hawaii would not do that. The reason being, and McPhee puts it in a rather pithy fashion, he said that in Iceland, the land of the fair, you could get away with a diversionary tactic like this. In the United States of America, the land of the lawyer, you couldn't even dream of it. Being that you diverted it away from one subdivision and it went someplace and through another subdivision, the state of Hawaii didn't want any of that action. There's actually another pithy statement on a somewhat different but related topic by the director of the United States Geological Survey a few years back. This will, you Southern Californians will enjoy this as well. But San Andreas Fault in Southern California, of course, hangs up and moves in snaps and spurts, and that's why you have earthquakes. Where when you go up in the South Bay area to Hollister, you see the buildings basically being shifted off their foundations, but the San Andreas and its companion faults are just creeping along. And once upon a time, the United States Geological Survey got thinking that maybe we will pump water and waste oils and all these kinds of things into the trace of the San Andreas Fault in Southern California and lubricate it so that it'll slide more easily and we won't get large earthquakes. And the director of the United States Geological Survey made a statement much akin to the one that was made in Hawaii. He said, "It is one thing entirely for the San Andreas to move as an act of God, It's another thing entirely for it to move is an act of the Director of the United States Geological Survey. And so that idea was scrapped as well. There are lots of
other things, though, that are far more insidious, and until 1980, people didn't think anywhere near as much about. Geologists have a term that they refer to as pyroclastic. Pyromania, pyromaniacs, you can handle that, somebody who likes to play with fire. Pyroclastics are fire-formed particles, little pieces of cinder and ash, and these kinds of things. And so geologists use this as a broad term to describe these kinds of things. Pyroclastics were what were at work on Mount St. Helens. It wasn't lava flowing gently, it was pyroclastics blowing out in a huge cloud of smoke and ash and cinders and all this sort of stuff, and with great explosive force. We touched on why that was a couple of days ago. But it has to do with how thick, viscous the lava is, and its tendency to get choked and blowing up.
Mount St. Helens blew up, and many of you were close at hand. Some of you closer at hand than what you would have liked. But many of you were close at hand, and I suspect that a good many of you paid fairly close attention because we had the advantage of great national media coverage of this. When Mount St. Helens blew up, there was approximately a cubic kilometer of material that blew out the northeast side of Mount St. Helens. Approximately a cubic kilometer. What that translates into is 600,000 tons that fell all over Yakima alone. Of course, nobody on that side of the mountains cared much, right? Who cares about Yakima? 600,000 tons of that fell in Yakima. If we get enough time here toward the end of this, I have some high-altitude photographs of that day, high-altitude being 22,000 miles up, where you can see the ash cloud spread out not only across all of the rest of Washington, but Idaho and into Montana. And this is just on the 18th. Mount St. Helens is a relatively small fry. As far as volcanoes go, self-same Mount Mazama, Crater Lake, eruption approximately 4,000 or 500,000 BC, 4,000, 5,000 BC, something like that. The material there was over 40 cubic kilometers, 40 times the size of the St. Helens. When Mount Tambora blew in Indonesia, in 1815, over 30 cubic kilometers of material. Those of you who are interested in world history, here's another little tidbit to add to it. 1815 was when Tambora blew. 1816 was known basically all around the civilized world as the year without a summer. 30 cubic kilometers would change the climate of the globe dramatically for a year. One of the problems at Mount St. Helens, and a problem with a lot of South American volcanoes, is that when you get something that tends to have pyroclastic eruptions, and you mix that with snow and ice, you end up with something that geologists refer to as a lahar. When Mount St. Helens blew, great heat involved. And the heat melted the snow and the ice on the side of the mountain and turned it into a lahar, or a great big mud flow or debris flow, which rolled down the side of the mountain. Again, Mount St. Helens, small fry in this. In 85, Nevada del Ruiz in Colombia, South America, the same thing happened. A giant lahar was formed, went down an avalanche chute. I don't know if you've got the story of the town yet here at Holden, but we're in fairly good shape right here, because the avalanche chutes are on either side of us. If you're over here on the tailings piles and looking across on this face, you'll see them. It's very obvious. It's the little drainages. That's the avalanche chutes. And one of the problems that people had up at the village over here was that during the winter months, the avalanche would come down the avalanche chute, and it would separate the buildings up here in the Winston Town site from right here. And of course, this was the school, so one of your jobs, Mom, didn't have enough jobs as it was. One of your jobs was to do avalanche patrol, make sure the kids got home all right. In South America, there were two towns that were built in the avalanche trail. And there were 20,000 people killed by a large lahar, a mud debris flow that came down off of Ruiz. A nuit ardente. The French is for glowing cloud. It's perhaps the most striking of all of these things because it looks like the gates of hell have opened wide and are about set to engulf you. It is where literally a cloud, an incandescent cloud, temperatures of 1,000 degrees centigrade, pieces of ash, glowing embers, hot gases come racing down the mountainside. Sometimes these things have been clocked at over 100 miles an hour, but you can't run away from them. And in 1902, on the island of Martinique, town of St. Pierre, virtually all of the people of Martinique had gathered because it was time to vote. It was a national election. They were in town. Mount Pele blew up about 5 or 6 miles away from the town. And every person save one in the town was killed. That person was a guy who'd been thrown in the slammer overnight. The slammer was underground. The whole town came down on top of him. It took him 4 days to finally dig him out after rescuers got there. And somewhere, and they don't have a real good handle because the population of the town was about 25,000, but they figured maybe up to 40,000 people were actually there with other people coming in town. No one else survived. No one else survived that New York on. It's going 100 miles an hour and it's only 5 miles away. It's going to get there very quickly. New York on. Those of you who paying attention to some global affairs back in 1986, the Cameroon, or Cameroon, West Africa, the Lake Nyos, something about like that, and the approximately 2,000 people that were killed there, carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is not a fundamentally toxic gas to us. Not like carbon monoxide, but if that's all there is to breathe, you're in deep trouble. And that's what happened in Cameroon. That actually happened to a few people on Haimaan Island. One of the interesting things about volcanoes is it disturbs the atmosphere so much that you'll actually generate electrical storms, and you'll generate lightning in the cloud. It didn't look bad enough to you as it was. Then there's this lightning and thunder show going on. But the volcano also emitted carbon dioxide, among other gases. And in the evening, right about sunset, while the volcano was going off and the lightning show was going on, you could see the carbon dioxide come down the hill. You could actually see the gas cloud of carbon dioxide come down the hill. The atmospheric conditions were just right to differentiate it from the rest of the atmosphere, and they could see it come down towards them. And so everybody got up to the top level of their house, because the carbon dioxide is heavier than the air, sank into the low places, which is what happened in Cameroon. People are living in low places were killed. Carbon dioxide, water vapor, the noxious gases would be the sulfur oxides, dioxides, these kinds of things. Also has a bad habit of emitting hydrochloric acid, volcanoes do. So So not necessarily great places to be around. In 1883, in Indonesia, not too far from where Tamboro flew in 1815, small island of Krakatoa. And Krakatoa was a different kind of thing again. Krakatoa, small volcanic island, in which the vent systems and some of the fractures that developed inside the volcano were unfortunately at about sea level and just below. And the thinking is that millions and millions and millions of gallons of seawater poured into the magma chamber and flashed immediately to steam. A great many people, geologists, historians alike, consider it to be the loudest sound ever produced on the face of this planet. That it was heard 3,000 miles away on the far side of Australia. That there was actually one fellow British naval commander who heard it in the South Atlantic when the thing blew up. There wasn't anybody living on Krakatoa. Nobody lived there. Uninhabited island. 36,000 people were killed. 36,000 people were killed all throughout Indonesia because Krakatoa, that explosion, generated a tsunami. How many of you guys are part of the surf crowd down at Newport? You go down there occasionally? Nah, not too much. So, those of you who have been to the beach a few times, I'm not much on the surf crowd either, but I do like the boogie board. So you go out and you boogie board, right? You're out in the water, you're kind of dog paddling around, and all of a sudden one of those waves comes up you haven't been paying attention to, and there's a 4 or 5 foot high wave, and unfortunately that son of a gun's about set to break on you, so you got to dive in underneath there. But if any of you have been at the beach and in the water, and you're dog paddling around, and there's a 5 foot high wave, that thing looks pretty doggone monstrous when you're just got your head out of the water. The historical record for the tsunami from Krakatoa was that the height that thing attained on some of the Indonesian islands was 40 meters. And those islands, a lot of them were very flat lying. There wasn't any place on the island that was 120 feet tall. And it wiped out a great many of the indigenous peoples in Indonesia. Here's a tip for you, by the way. This is something I always have fun with. But you know when a tsunami is coming in to the beach? It's when all the water disappears.
It sucks it out.
See, what happens in the tsunami is that the waveform is generated. And as long as the waveform is out in the open ocean, it's no big thing. That's why the Poseidon Adventure was so hokey. Remember the Poseidon Adventure? Ernest Borgnine and the whole ship turning over upside down, all this sort of stuff. Believe it or not, U.S. Geological Survey and the Coast Guard, whenever an earthquake goes off in Alaska, they send the boats out. They send the boats out and the airplanes out, and they'll see the tidal wave, which is a misnomer. They'll see the tsunami because it's traveling in a certain direction and it's got a certain speed. But in the open ocean, it's no bigger than any other wave. In order to preserve the wave form, it needs water. So you're laying on the beach at Malibu. Better that than Newport, right? Going out to the beach at Malibu. You're laying on the beach at Malibu, soaking up a few rays, having a good time. You look up, and all of a sudden, the water is way out there. You turn around and run for the hills just as fast as you possibly can, which is a good thing to do in Malibu because there are hills there close at hand. On some of those Indonesian islands, there just wasn't enough hill. Just a travel tip whenever you're in Southern California. This summer, you know, you're laying out the beach, kind of keep an eye out for that. But when you live in an area where there is volcanic activity, there are lots of things to think about. And one of the good things I think about St. Helens was that it sort of forced this hazard on a national consciousness in a way that nobody had ever thought about before. I would dare say, I know it, you know, even with training as a geologist and knowing all of these things, it really wasn't until seeing it that it kind of forced you to think about it. So there are a variety of types of volcanic hazards. Those of you who continue to live, in this country anyway, in the Pacific Northwest, are going to live with this kind of hazard. You're going to live with this kind of hazard. People who live in Hawaii are going to live with this kind of hazard. Fortunately, there's not too many people that live in the Aleutian chain, but that hazard will be in that part of the world as well. The jury is still out with respect to Yellowstone. There is a hazard, a volcanic hazard to Yellowstone. Those hot geysers and Old Faithful and all that stuff, they're not there just by accident. There's a reason for that. But in some respects, one of the most frightening of all is the Mammoth Lakes area and the Long Valley Caldera of Eastern California. It has been carrying the same kind of signature with respect to activity that St. Helens did. It's been carrying it for quite a while now, since it started about 10 or 12 years ago. But USGS is still convinced that it is a very dangerous area, and again went to the unusual lengths of actually issuing a volcanic hazard notice in a formal sense for the area. I've got a few slides. Is there something that we can touch on briefly before we look at some of this? Why don't we have a look at just a few things that I've got here, and then field whatever else anybody wants to chat about. And you might try that window right there if you grab that curtain. Be kind of careful though, so that the rod doesn't come down. I had a fall on my head the other day. Okay, and now let me get the lights on this thing. Do I not have lights? See if I've kicked that top part all the way over far enough.
The bulb was burned up.
Well, that would be no good whatsoever.
Yeah, that maybe, I think you just blew it, yes. No,
that's exactly what we did. We just blew the bulb.
Ross, we need a bulb.
See, he's paying attention.
Check in the front.
There should have been, but there isn't.
Don't see one? Don't see one in there?
Nope. Yeah, it is. Where is he?
Well, let's, yeah, let's...
Well, yeah, admit it. We lived in Shelton, which is about 100 miles away, and Mount St. Helens blew up. It was Sunday, and we were coming home from church, and heard about it, so I gathered my kids and some other people that were working with them. We chartered a little airplane, and as soon as we could get elevated, we'd see it. And so we got there in the afternoon, and it was probably one of the most awesome sights that I've ever experienced. And so it was something that's indescribable, because it was 100 miles across the smoke column, still venting. Started at 8:30 in the morning and it vented till 6:30 at night. We were there about 5. So it was still venting at full bore.
Yeah.
For a mile wide column, which we couldn't see the top of because of the clouds and lightning,
right.
Strike. Clouds moving at like slow motion. We couldn't be any closer than 10 miles from the cloud and 10,000 feet high. FAA regulations is how close we can get. But it's just awesome to see this big lobe and then the yellow lightning that strike from the cloud
Yeah.
It's lightning, not moving around, it's just then, you know, because we had any idea of the extent of, so we flew over river valleys filled with mud, and you'd see a road go, and then there'd just be mud, and then the road would start on the other side.
Yeah.
We weren't close enough to see houses, but we could see the valley, so the railroad trestles going and stopping. I mean, it was the most awesome thing I've ever experienced in my life. So I keep going every year now. I fly down most every year, or hike to the rim a couple of years ago, and look down to the building, and you get hooked on it.
That's, in fact, there's a term among the geologists who work volcanoes. They say they have red rock fever. And they will do some amazing things. In fact, one of the things in this story here by McPhee that is fascinating to me is how little of a crust the folks in Iceland needed in order to do their work. That a crust an inch to an inch and a half thick would support a person, although they burned up a lot of pairs of boots in doing this, but a crust an inch to an inch and a half would support a person. And if they could get the crust about 8 or 9 inches to a foot thick, they would go up on top of the lava flow with bulldozers. They would actually take the bulldozers up on top of the lava. They found that it wasn't enough to just shoot water on the edge of the lava flow. They needed to get back up and cool as much of the mass as they could, so they would get, they actually got, believe it or not, plastic pipes that they ran up on top of the lava flow. And the reason they could get away with that, because the water in winter in Iceland was so cold that the water inside the pipes would keep them cool enough. If the pumps went down, then that was another thing. And the crews would follow the pipes up because the steam was so thick that they couldn't see. And they did all their work by figuring out whether or not there was any steam. And if there's a lot of steam at work, they knew they had work to do. And if there wasn't any steam, they knew it was safe to move on. Surprisingly enough, nobody that worked on the lava flow was killed. There were a few people who were killed in the town from carbon dioxide suffocation, where they cut off the air. But no one was killed on top of the lava flow, partly because they worked in pairs, with one person working the hose, the next person standing right beside and keeping an eye out up in the air for volcanic bombs about set to land on their head. And the rule was that they had a procedure they went through. The rule was that when the guy made the call that there was a volcanic bomb up in the air, then they stopped, they watched the bomb, and the idea was you were going to wait until almost time it was going to hit you before you decided to move. If it wasn't going to hit you, then you just stood stock still. It was safer that way. And that was their procedure for doing that kind of work.
Do they have a geologist coming up and they just fly up and see their pants or what?
They had, and the story is very good about the principal players. There's a geologist, there is a physicist who worked in geophysics, and there's a guy that they referred to as Patton, as in George S. And his name wasn't Patton, you know, it was Arne Schachterson or something like that. You know, it was, and, but they called him Patton because he was the guy that ramrodded the whole operation and kind of took care of this. So they had various players at work, and they would have a council of war, literally, every day. They'd sit down and figure out, well, this is what we're going to try and work on today. And they had to make some interesting decisions, because the principal thing was the harbor. And when the volcano started threatening the harbor and the town, they had to make a decision to let some of the town go in order to save the harbor. For those of you of Scandinavian background that don't mind swimming in frigid waters, I went swimming up at Heart Lake yesterday. And I didn't stay in very long. But one of the really fascinating stories about the Iceland national character that comes out of this is a story of a guy who was on his fishing boat and got a little too close to the action. And I forget exactly how it happened, but his boat overturned. And this was in February or March in Iceland, and he was thrown into the water. And I think the temperature of the water was 40, 42 degrees, something like that. The man was in the water for 8 hours. Actually, you should be dead in just a few minutes, right? He was in the water for 8 hours, and then he climbed out on land. He was barefoot by this time, and he kicked off his shoes so he could swim. He was barefoot, walked about a mile and a half to somebody's house through the snow barefoot, and basically went about his business the next day. Some research institute down in Great Britain found out about it after it was all over, asked him to come down so they could do some experiments. And they got a big tub of water, and they chilled it to about 38, 40 degrees, and they put this guy in here to monitor him. About 3 hours later, he was so bored about things, he was not swimming. He was not swimming, he was just floating on his back in this 40 degree water. He was so bored, he asked him to wheel in a television so he could watch television while they were doing this. And the British were completely blown away and figured that this guy basically had a subcutaneous fat layer like a seal, so that he'd be like a seal in the water. A built-in wetsuit. And the British were really impressed by this. And the Icelanders' response was, "We've known this guy all our life. Not only is he fat, he's a terrible swimmer." Anyway, the story is really fascinating. Not that I'm hawking the book too much, but at $9.95, The Price is Right, too. And an absolutely amazing story of the fight by the island of Heimé to save the harbor, and a great deal of Iceland's economy as a result of it. What else? It's about that time.
In a case like this, you kind of find your lawyer have people addressed who owns that land that's created either here or in Hawaii, you know, where you have vast additions to it? Does it belong to the state?
In Iceland, that's the case, unquestionably. Now, in terms of new land in Hawaii, I'm not all that sure. Of course, the other part of it is the question that was put to the homeowner whose house burnt down outside of Hilo, and they said, "Why did you build here?" And the answer was, "Because the land is so cheap." So, you know, I mean, it would. I mean, I'm.
Well, and initially, it's not worth much, you know, when all you got is a bunch of
right
hardened lava.
Right. Just where it was exactly. Yeah. Well, I've no doubt that some enterprising real estate agent in Hilo is probably going to buy up some of this and try to do it. And it's interesting, there really still in Hawaii is no kind of volcanic hazard zoning to where this kind of practice still goes on, as a matter of fact.
I took a picture in Hawaii,
Exactly. Well, there was a question. You guys want to? Okay. Well, let's. If you guys want to, this won't take but a few minutes. Yeah, I can't imagine that. Yeah. All right. Okay, got the lamp all the way up, Russ?
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
Okay. Okay, yeah, let me back up. I'm going to have to talk very loudly, you're right. Okay, I'm going to talk very loudly.
So we can stay with this.
This, folks, is the view of Mauna Loa from the summit vicinity of Kilauea. So we are on the big island of Hawaii.
Thank you.
Do yes.
I have to move over there?
No, no, I'll just step over this way a little bit farther. Now, the thing of it is that it doesn't look like much. Well, if you remember back to Geology 101 from your college days, this is one of the prime examples of what's called a shield volcano. Pretty obvious. The big shield shape. The thing that is so amazing, though, is that when push comes to shove, this is a 33,000-foot-high mountain. I mean, there's only 13 and change above sea level, but the Pacific is very deep in this part of the world. Everest isn't this tall. That 13,000 feet above sea level, in a different climate, and in an inactive volcanic area, is going to get dissected, and you're going to see something like the Swiss Alps or the Cascades of the Pacific Northwest. If it's volcanically active, it's building, the lava is of the right nature, and this big shield is all you see. And yeah, it just doesn't look like that much. I mean, all you folks are sitting here in Washington and seeing the Cascades saying, God, that's ugly. But that's nevertheless an impressive mountain. It really is. This is the smaller of the two summit craters at Kilauea. This is the easternmost, and I forget the name exactly, but it's a very long Hawaiian name, sort of like Kamehameha, but not Halemaumau or something like that. This is, let the whole thing roll. But this is where the volcanic activity has been emanating since the early 70s. So we've had 20 years of volcanic activity off of Kilauea, and it's basically right around this area. Obviously, an enterprising geologist got this close to this while this kind of activity was going on. They're showing you the crack right here where the edge is about set to collapse and fall into the middle of the lake. Crazy geologists abound where there's natural hazards. This is, for those of you who've never seen anything look quite like it, a recording seismograph at the Kilauea Volcanic Observatory. Now, when you see things spike back and forth like this, that's an earthquake, right? That's an earthquake. Charles Richter, back in the 30s at Caltech, was staring at a device just like this when he had his eureka moment. Remember Archimedes sitting in his bathtub doing his eureka thing? Charles Richter had a eureka moment back in the 30s when he noticed how far back and forth the pins swung. That's what gave us the Richter scale for earthquakes. We got that by looking at this thing. About 250 feet high, that lava fountain is kicking out of the east crater there at Kilauea. And of course, you get a view of the surface of this, the cracks in the lava. It's just a crust floating on top of that lava lake. Actually, it's kind of a nice corollary to the larger plate tectonic theory for geologists, the mobile plates floating around on a molten layer underneath. Pretty nice show. Closer to home, one of the things that I've always found interesting in discussions like this is talking about volcanic rocks and people wanting to know where the volcano was when we're talking about a bunch of volcanic rocks someplace. In this case, craters of the moon in Idaho. But it doesn't have to be Idaho. It could be over here in Washington and Oregon as well. There are more what are called flood basalts here than any place else in North America. And you folks have seen them because you've been up and down the Columbia River Gorge. There's nothing but those flood basalts. And they cover thousands, hundreds of thousands of square miles. And the first question people ask is, where's the volcano? And the answer is, there wasn't one. You don't have to have a volcano to have volcanic rocks. That line right there is the fissure, the crack in the ground out of which volcanic rock emanates as lava and it's spread out and flooded all over this part of the world. You don't have to have a volcano to have volcanic rocks. And you can see that here. You can see that on the Snake River Plain. You can see it in what are known as the Deccan Traps in central India. Lots of places around the world that this sort of thing happens. This is just outside of Idaho Falls, Idaho. And terribly obvious to see the extent of the flood basalt here with the nice flat cropland over here toward the right and that really badlands topography. In New Mexico and far southwest Texas, we call this the Malpai, the bad land on these lava fields. And there's lava fields like this in far southwest Texas, too, in what we call the Trans-Pecos. This is at Grand Coulee, but this could be going down the interstate, any place up and down the Columbia. Those are all the flood basalts. And see this little swoop in here, perhaps a topography is developing, and then the next lava flow coming in and filling this stuff in. There are a number of lava flows at work in here, several generations of it. Okay, now, if you take a fairly careful look down low, right in here and over here, this is an older photograph is taken in 1968 from Luzon in the southern Philippines. There is a big stratovolcano or composite volcano blowing up, and those clouds that you see, they aren't going up in the air with the rest of that eruption. Those are nuyordants that are heading down the side of the mountain. There were some small ones at St. Helens. These are some pretty big big ones that are at work here. That's the glowing cloud, fiery gas and ash, something you don't want to be anywhere near. Who's got it? What's that profile? That's actually a pretty distinctive profile. California crowd, it's on you. This is Shasta and Shastina. The thing that you should pick out, you can see the scar of the road across here. Look at that large, large lava flow. You're looking what kind of, no, I think you're looking south, southeast-ish, aren't you? I think so. But look at the size of that lava flow and notice the lobes of it way down here below road level. The road has cut across that old lava flow.
Is that the interstate? Or just some road?
I don't think that's the interstate. Who's been up there recently? I don't think so. But that is a spectacular strato or composite volcano like Rainier, like St. Helens, like Adams, like Baker, like Hood. There's a little different situation. This is back in the American Southwest again. And this is an unusual photograph in that it was taken with ektachrome infrared film. So all the reddish you see there is really green, is the vegetation. This is Mount Taylor. If you're standing up on the Sandia Heights of Albuquerque and looking off west at sunset, you'll see the remains of a stratovolcano out there that's Mount Taylor. The heart of the volcano is gone. This is the rim around it, and it's a series of peaks. The top is blown, the top is gone. not only Mount Taylor, but if you're driving on I-40 from Albuquerque on your way to Los Angeles and you go over the hump there at Flagstaff, Arizona, you'll see the San Francisco peaks, as in several. Mount Humphreys, Agassiz, Doyle. And you stand back far enough and realize that that was a stratovolcano in one mountain, while you can kind of project up from the outside peaks to the top. When you do that, you come up with a mountain in excess of 20,000 feet in elevation before it blew up. This is the cinder cone Perucutin in central Mexico. It was actually, and those of you with small children may have the book, I know we do, story of a little boy who says it's boring here in my village. You remember that? It's so boring here in my village, Papa. Can't we do something exciting? Well, things got exciting in this little village back in the 40s. When the fellow went out to till his cornfield and found the ground opening up and swallowing his plow, and almost him and his mule as well, not to mention the young lad who was out for adventure. And Perucutin was the result. And it's a cinder cone, the smallest of the three types of volcanoes. But when it happens in your backyard, it's plenty big enough. And one of the things that you'll notice is that the lava is emanating from over here at the base and at the side. This is an additional hazard, and certainly was the case with St. Helens. Had St. Helens blown straight up, there probably would not have been the loss of life 5 and 10 miles away to the northeast. On the other hand, if St. Helens had blown out to the southwest, life would have been real interesting in some of your neighborhoods.
You said Helens blew northwest?
Northeast, more than northwest. Yeah. It, considering it blew out the side, it was about as good a situation as you could have had. It's one of my favorite parts of the world. Almost doesn't look like any part of the world that you know, does it? In fact, it looks like the moon, and that is exactly why the United States Geological Survey has what they call an astrogeology center in Flagstaff, Arizona. This is the San Francisco Peaks Volcanic Field. It is back on the north side of San Francisco Peaks. Among other things, Sunset Crater is there, that thing that erupted in 1066. And among other things, this is where the Apollo astronauts trained for their driving around on the moon. So those of you my age and older remembering the lunar rover rolling around the surface of the moon, this is where they tested it. They tested it here north of Flagstaff. And it is. It's virtually a moonscape.
What's the black stuff? It looks like it's going through. Are we facing downhill?
We are above essentially a flat plain. And all of these things are cinder cones, including this gorgeous little one right here that is so wonderfully symmetrical. If you look at it on the USGS topographic maps, you'll find that that little cinder cone is identified as SP, as in the letters, SP crater. That's because the original geologist out there had an interesting sense of humor, and he called it, and I will put it in a slightly different vernacular, but you'll get the idea, manure pot crater. And I figured that would not do on any of the USGS maps, so it is simply referred to as SP crater. And the neat thing there is, of course, the lava flow, and that's what you're asking about, the black, has come out, again, at the base of the crater and come off in our direction. And it's come basically across sort of flat ground. The relief is the little scarps like you see here with the lava actually rolled down to the edge. In the Gulf of California is a little thing called Isla Intacada. in the Gulf, in other words, between the Mexican mainland and the Baja. And here is the remains of a crater that has blown out, and this nice lava. The bottom of the crater is actually below sea level, and there's a bermed area there that prevents the water from going down into it. But I sure like the looks of the water there. I'd actually like to go spend some time down there. But this is on what's called the East Pacific Rise, which is the hot spot that is responsible. Now we're getting back close to home for you guys. This is the hot spot that's responsible for all that geothermal energy that you find down in the Salton Trough in the Imperial Valley. Okay, and so the Salton Sea and all of those warms, Murrieta hot springs and those kinds of things, geologically are tied to this thing farther down in the Gulf. And I think the last thing here is kind of a cute little piece of volcanic work south of Gallup, New Mexico. As a matter of fact, this is Zuni Lake or something like that, and it's 60, 70 miles south of Gallup, New Mexico. And you can see the whole outline of the caldera of the old volcano. That little crater, and you know, you can do craters, crater lake, volcanic craters. That's not too hard a thing to get a handle on. We tend to find those at the summit of the mountain, the very top, some nice little depression, we call it a crater. When the volcano is basically blown completely apart and destroyed the vast majority of the mountain, we talk about a volcanic caldera. Here's a little caldera from here to here is only a matter of several hundred yards. And in the middle of it, it's kind of a nice resurgent little cinder cone and little stepbrother as well. The thing that this slide I think is instructive for you to realize that the Long Valley caldera is this same kind of thing. Only, again, Californians, Bishop is over here. Mammoth Mountains are 80 miles, something like that. The south entrance to Yellowstone is over here, Montana border is someplace. Yellowstone is basically just a volcanic caldera. So there are some amazing volcanic spots in this country. And the USGS is rightly concerned about some of them. There are some areas that still constitute a very dynamic volcanic hazard. And you go to them and live in them at a certain amount of risk. I think that's all I wanted to show for slides, so let me bring the lights back up. If there's anything else you want to kick around, well, we can do that for a moment.
I wonder what we're going to do about the picnic.
Yeah, if you want to.
Didn't you say you had some pictures of 22,000 miles up?
Oh, that's right. I've got, it's on a different carousel, but I've got some St. Helens stuff.
Yeah?
Yeah? Another 4 or 5 minutes? That's raining. I don't want to.
I'm glad you reminded her of that.
Sure, it's not 10 out of 5.
What, from the south entrance to the Montana line is 40 miles?
Something. How tall is that one?
Perhaps 30,000 feet.
How long ago was that?
last documented eruption that I know of would have been, and don't hold me strictly to this, but it seems like it was 400,000 years was the date on that. It's been a while. But, you know, there is a magma chamber there, and all of those hot springs and geysers and fumaroles and all that sort of stuff, they're being heated by a magma chamber that we think is no more than 3 to 4 kilometers below the surface, based on some geophysical measurements.
Is that good to look at?
As far as geologists are concerned, that counts as active. That counts as active. Okay, let's see what we might be able to come up with here. Unfortunate Spirit Lake, right? The mud damming the thing up. So this is a photograph after the fact. Those of you who spent time around here know what a tragedy this really was. Yeah.
Spirit River Valley.
That's the valley at, I think, the west end, damming up the valley. I think we've got one of the lake with all the trees in it. But you know, speaking of a landscape, it looks like it's from someplace else. There was, I believe, I wrote this stuff down to make sure that I had some of this. Yeah, that's the March 30th eruption. Okay, that was the thing that got everybody kind of on full alert. Things are going to happen here. So that was the March 30th eruption, which looked fairly spectacular from this angle, just as it was. The of course, you recognize the snow on the mountain, but dustings from some of the early eruptions, the March 30th eruption, this kind of stuff, the dustings of ash, really highlighted one of the old lava flows down the side of the mountain. It makes it stand out very nicely for you. So this mountain has had some substantial activity in the past. That is a large lava flow. Now, there's your lake. And it's just jammed full of trees and junk. And can't canoe through that stuff.
Yes. They have full enough, but the logs keep rushing from one side to the other.
Right. After we finish our stint here, we're going to go down to Cougar for about 3 days. And I want to see some of this stuff. That's all I've heard. But again, those of you who live in this part of the world know what this place was like prior to the eruption. The stories I've been told, anyway, Spirit Lake was just about as nice a spot as there was in the Cascades. That's a steam venting. What's the date? That's still a... Oh no, that's a May 30th. That's after the fact. That's an after the fact steam venting. The next one is, yeah. There's a forum looking landscape. This is part of a pyroclastic flow. Right? This picture was taken on the 19th, so this was the day after. This is part of a pyroclastic flow. And yeah, this almost looks like that one thing we saw a minute ago, like it ought to be on the moon. Now this is a weird landscape, or maybe like something you'd expect to see on Mars. It just totally obliterated that previous landscape.
That's how I saw it.
That's how most of you in the Portland, Vancouver area and off the southwest would have seen the eruption. This is high altitude infrared photograph from the 19th at St. Helens is off over here. There were actually a couple of summit craters through the month of April, and one of the things the USGS was watching was how these things were behaving. This was a little earlier in the month of April. This was later in the month of April. Those photographs look quite different, but it's the same part of the world. And the summit craters have coalesced. the heat flow is higher, snow and ice has melted off of here, and this is one of the things that Dave Johnson, among others, was looking at in worrying about just how imminent this eruption is going to be. This is actually just immediately before the eruption. Notice the difference in the mountain. The snow and ice is not there. This is the north side. It's getting ready to bulge here. Some fracturing, some of these dark lines that are displacing the snow in here, some fracturing at the summit, which was another tip-off that the eruption was at hand. Another view of the north side. Let's flash on through this. The thing that actually triggered this whole thing blowing out was a massive landslide off the northeast side. Earthquake hit this thing. Remember the northeast side bulged by some accounts 200, 300 feet bulged. That'd be quite a ride to be standing on what you'd think solid ground and have it bulged by that. Earthquake happened. Kind of look at the profile of the mountain in this slide and then see the thing flattening out in here. The landslide is underway, and now the mountain's going to blow out. It was.
That's still there. Bare members of the mountain blew down there. Check before you hit it.
Yeah. But these pictures were taken from what, 8-10 miles away? They were taken from a long ways away. That sort of looks.
You can find these, like that.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's me kind of what the gates of hell looks like. Here's the thing you're asking about. All right. So this is start of the day. St. John's is up in here. This would have been the morning. That would have been midday. And that was later in the afternoon. It was a substantial effect. And that's the afternoon. That's from the northeast side. Those are enormous trees there that are laying around like matchsticks. I think we probably pushed this about long enough, guys, if we want to get to supper. So, yeah.